Scottish Qualifications Authority, National Qualifications 2015. English for Speakers of Other Languages, National 5. Recording 1. Listen to the recording and attempt the questions which follow. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in recording 1 before the recording begins.
And if you want to hear that programme again, remember, you can listen to it on our website. Now, it's beginning to look as if the rain will never stop, and flooding's been on the news every day recently. So, our next programme, in the Environment and Me series, features Mark Rutherford from the Environmental Council, and he's here to talk about flooding.
My work with flooding means that I have to get out and about and look at floods, and I know very well the misery that they can cause. It's interesting the divisions that flooding shows amongst people. Those who live in any area which doesn't flood can often be quite unsympathetic. You hear them say things like, "Why did you buy a house there?" Well, the answer might be, "Because this area was the only one that we could afford." Or, sometimes, "Because nobody told me that there was a risk of flooding." The fact is that over the past few years, thousands of houses have been built in areas where they should never have been built. The most obvious of these are floodplains. If you live on flat land, next to a river, there's a chance that you'll be flooded sooner or later. That's why the land is flat, because over thousands of years the river has flooded over it. Now, it was probably a bad idea to give planning permission for houses in high-risk flooding areas, but it's a complex situation. Sometimes these were the only places where we could build new houses. But the result is that many houses today are at risk of flooding, and the risk seems to be increasing. Maybe this is due to global warming, or maybe it's simply a natural cycle in the climate. But we are seeing increasingly severe weather these days, with more storms and greater rain falling in a shorter period of time. So what can we do about it? The problem is that houses are essentially designed to keep out water falling from above, that is, rain, and not water coming in from below. So it all comes down to how much water you can expect. If the water is running down the street, there are certain things you should do to keep it moving past your house. You can put down sandbags, you can install a flood barrier, a waterproof plate that fits over the front of your door. However, if the level rises, sooner or later, the water is going to come up through the floorboards. There are certain things you can do to limit the damage, though. Take a look at your garden, for example. Have you laid concrete slabs all over it? These will stop water draining away, whereas grass or earth will allow it to sink into the ground. But if you find the water has entered your house, you may have to retreat. If you only live on one floor, this may well mean moving out, and you can only hope that your town or city is going to help with alternative accommodation. However, if you have an upper floor, it might be possible to live there for some time. There are some things you need to do before abandoning the ground floor. Turn off the electricity and gas at the mains. That's an obvious one. And you may want to move some furniture and carpets upstairs out of harm's way. And of course, if you keep any important documents downstairs, passport, insurance policies, and so on, make sure to take them with you. Now, when you go upstairs, there are a few things you're going to need. We'd actually recommend that if there's a risk of flooding, you prepare a flood kit in advance and keep it upstairs. So what should you include? Food, of course. And the most useful food is tinned, because you don't need to worry about it going off. So don't forget to add a tin opener. Of course, on the day of the flood, you might have time to empty the fridge and also take anything that will keep for a while. And you need bottled water. Buy it from the shops so you know it's safe. If you bottle your own, there's always a risk of some bugs getting in. You'll also need warm clothes. Remember, your heating system won't be working, so it's a good idea to keep old clothes instead of throwing them out. Some extra blankets would be useful too, if you don't normally store them upstairs. You'll also need a radio.
And if you want to hear that programme again, remember, you can listen to it on our website. Now, it's beginning to look as if the rain will never stop, and flooding's been on the news every day recently. So, our next programme, In the Environment and Me series, features Mark Rutherford from the Environmental Council, and he's here to talk about flooding.
My work with flooding means that I have to get out and about and look at floods, and I know very well the misery that they can cause. It's interesting the divisions that flooding shows amongst people. Those who live in any area which doesn't flood can often be quite unsympathetic. You hear them say things like, "Why did you buy a house there?" Well, the answer might be, "Because this area was the only one that we could afford." Or, sometimes, "Because nobody told me that there was a risk of flooding." The fact is that over the past few years, thousands of houses have been built in areas where they should never have been built. The most obvious of these are floodplains. If you live on flat land next to a river, there's a chance that you'll be flooded sooner or later. That's why the land is flat, because over thousands of years the river has flooded over it. Now, it was probably a bad idea to give planning permission for houses in high-risk flooding areas, but it's a complex situation. Sometimes these were the only places where we could build new houses. But the result is that many houses today are at risk of flooding, and the risk seems to be increasing. Maybe this is due to global warming, or maybe it's simply a natural cycle in the climate. But we are seeing increasingly severe weather these days, with more storms and greater rain falling in a shorter period of time. So what can we do about it? The problem is that houses are essentially designed to keep out water falling from above, that is, rain, and not water coming in from below. So it all comes down to how much water you can expect. If the water is running down the street, there are certain things you should do to keep it moving past your house. You can put down sandbags, you can install a flood barrier, a waterproof plate that fits over the front of your door. However, if the level rises, sooner or later, the water is going to come up through the floorboards. There are certain things you can do to limit the damage, though. Take a look at your garden, for example. Have you laid concrete slabs all over it? These will stop water draining away, whereas grass or earth will allow it to sink into the ground. But if you find the water has entered your house, you may have to retreat. If you only live on one floor, this may well mean moving out, and you can only hope that your town or city is going to help with alternative accommodation. However, if you have an upper floor, it might be possible to live there for some time. There are some things you need to do before abandoning the ground floor. Turn off the electricity and gas at the mains. That's an obvious one. And you may want to move some furniture and carpets upstairs out of harm's way. And of course, if you keep any important documents downstairs, passport, insurance policies, and so on, make sure to take them with you. Now, when you go upstairs, there are a few things you're going to need. We'd actually recommend that if there's a risk of flooding, you prepare a flood kit in advance and keep it upstairs. So what should you include? Food, of course. And the most useful food is tinned, because you don't need to worry about it going off. So don't forget to add a tin opener. Of course, on the day of the flood, you might have time to empty the fridge and also take anything that will keep for a while. And you need bottled water. Buy it from the shops so you know it's safe. If you bottle your own, there's always a risk of some bugs getting in. You'll also need warm clothes. Remember, your heating system won't be working, so it's a good idea to keep old clothes instead of throwing them out. Some extra blankets would be useful too, if you don't normally store them upstairs. You'll also need a radio.
Recording 2. Listen to the recording and attempt the questions which follow. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in recording 2 before the recording begins.
It's 10 o'clock and you're listening to Raising Kids with me, Rachel McIver. There's been a lot of debate lately about virtual schools and online classrooms, and today we're going to explore some of the issues. Our guests are Sunita Park, a teacher from Perth.
Good morning.
Hello, Sunita. And Andrew Shearer, a software engineer from Shetland.
Hi.
Hello and welcome to both of you. Let's begin with the situation in Shetland. Andrew, I believe getting children to school in Shetland is time-consuming and costly.
That's right, Rachel. Shetland's in the far north of Scotland and it is made up of more than 100 islands. The majority of children have to transfer to the high school in Lerwick, the capital of Shetland. You can imagine how tricky it would be to ferry all the kids to school from every island every day. So children tend to stay in hostels in Lerwick during the week and go home at the weekends. It's hard for the kids, especially the younger ones, being away from home, and it's a shocking waste of public money. I think it's time to move into the 21st century and send kids to virtual schools.
How could online schools benefit pupils in Shetland?
Children could learn in the safety of their own homes and would save on the cost of transport, accommodation and school buildings.
What are your thoughts on that, Sunita?
I don't think we should be looking at this in financial terms. Virtual schools may appear cheaper, but we have to think of the children's needs first of all. A traditional school is a community that caters for children's social and emotional needs.
So kids need to be part of a real community. Andrew?
School communities don't suit everyone. I've got a bright 13-year-old nephew who suffered from bullying last year. His school life was miserable and his work went downhill fast. He's the kind of boy who works well on his own, without any distractions. Anyway, the breakthrough came when my sister enrolled him at a virtual school last term and he loves it. He has first-rate teachers, gets one-to-one attention and loads of support from the other pupils. He's already getting his confidence and motivation back.
It might be the answer for a small minority of children, but how do you replace the social element?
Support networks and communities are part of the design of a good virtual school. They have online communities, Chat rooms?
What good are they? Social skills play a crucial role in a child's emotional health and well-being. What they need is face-to-face interaction.
Virtual schools often organise a week away to get to know one another.
What can pupils learn in a week?
It's true they can't learn much in a week, but it kickstarts cooperation and support on the online forums and chat rooms. I just don't think traditional school environments work for everybody, whereas virtual schools can help children who are off sick long term, expatriates who have moved abroad, perhaps disabled kids and children who are being bullied at school.
Andrew, do you think that virtual schools could eventually replace real schools?
Theoretically, yes. I'm not saying that virtual learning is right for every child, but I do think we should have the option of choosing the best learning environment for each child.
Sunita, do you want to come in here?
Virtual schools would only suit a small minority of mature pupils and only perhaps for certain subjects like English, maths and computer science. What about practical subjects like music, art, home economics and PE? Also, virtual schools would encourage children to spend far too much time in front of screens. Think of the long-term health problems.
Andrew, isn't that a real danger?
Kids are brought up with technology. It's the older generation that have the problem with it. Besides, it'll help them learn to manage their own time.
How many children are good at time management? Who would oversee the learning? A lot of parents work, so they couldn't make sure kids are working hard or getting the right balance.
Let's go over to our first caller now. It's 10 o'clock and you're listening to Raising Kids with me, Rachel McIver. There's been a lot of debate lately about virtual schools and online classrooms, and today we're going to explore some of the issues. Our guests are Sunita Park, a teacher from Perth.
Good morning.
Hello, Sunita. And Andrew Shearer, a software engineer from Shetland.
Hi.
Hello and welcome to both of you. Let's begin with the situation in Shetland. Andrew, I believe getting children to school in Shetland is time-consuming and costly.
That's right, Rachel. Shetland's in the far north of Scotland and it is made up of more than 100 islands. The majority of children have to transfer to the high school in Lerwick, the capital of Shetland. You can imagine how tricky it would be to ferry all the kids to school from every island every day. So children tend to stay in hostels in Lerwick during the week and go home at the weekends. It's hard for the kids, especially the younger ones, being away from home, and it's a shocking waste of public money. I think it's time to move into the 21st century and send kids to virtual schools.
How could online schools benefit pupils in Shetland?
Children could learn in the safety of their own homes and would save on the cost of transport, accommodation and school buildings.
What are your thoughts on that, Sunita?
I don't think we should be looking at this in financial terms. Virtual schools may appear cheaper, but we have to think of the children's needs first of all. A traditional school is a community that caters for children's social and emotional needs.
So kids need to be part of a real community. Andrew?
School communities don't suit everyone. I've got a bright 13-year-old nephew who suffered from bullying last year. His school life was miserable and his work went downhill fast. He's the kind of boy who works well on his own, without any distractions. Anyway, the breakthrough came when my sister enrolled him at a virtual school last term and he loves it. He has first-rate teachers, gets one-to-one attention and loads of support from the other pupils. He's already getting his confidence and motivation back.
It might be the answer for a small minority of children, but how do you replace the social element?
Support networks and communities are part of the design of a good virtual school. They have online communities, chat rooms...
What good are they? Social skills play a crucial role in a child's emotional health and well-being. What they need is face-to-face interaction.
Virtual schools often organise a week away to get to know one another.
What can pupils learn in a week?
It's true they can't learn much in a week, but it kickstarts cooperation and support on the online forums and chat rooms. I just don't think traditional school environments work for everybody, whereas virtual schools can help children who are off sick long term, expatriates who have moved abroad, perhaps disabled kids and children who are being bullied at school.
Andrew, do you think that virtual schools could eventually replace real schools?
Theoretically, yes. I'm not saying that virtual learning is right for every child, but I do think we should have the option of choosing the best learning environment for each child.
Sunita, do you want to come in here?
Virtual schools would only suit a small minority of mature pupils and only perhaps for certain subjects like English, maths and computer science. What about practical subjects like music, art, home economics and PE? Also, virtual schools would encourage children to spend far too much time in front of screens. Think of the long-term health problems.
Andrew, isn't that a real danger?
Kids are brought up with technology. It's the older generation that have the problem with it. Besides, it'll help them learn to manage their own time.
How many children are good at time management? Who would oversee the learning? A lot of parents work, so they couldn't make sure kids are working hard or getting the right balance.
Let's go over to our first caller now.
You now have 1 minute to check your answers. This is the end of the listening test.